From South Dakota to Maryland, Louisiana to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, California trucking regulations are having an impact on states across the nation. Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation talks with Brian Wanner of Peter Brothers Trucking. As expected, Democrats won gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey, and Socialist Zoran Mandami was elected mayor of New York City. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case that will determine whether or not the president has the power to impose tariffs without the express consent of Congress. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And President Donald Trump was recently awarded a crown, trolling the No Kings movement. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. This week on American Radio Journal, we debut a new monthly feature entitled American Heroes. Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation will spotlight those fighting government overreach to protect our basic freedoms. Today, she is joined by Brian Wanner of Peter's Brother Trucking to discuss the economic impact of California trucking regulations on states across the country. Kathy?
Well, what if Florida decided how Michigan should regulate its lakes, or Texas dictated Oregon's school curriculum? That sounds pretty absurd, right? Well, that's exactly what's happening in Pennsylvania's trucking industry, except it is California calling the shots. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today is Brian Wanner, president of Peter's Brothers Trucking, a proud family-run business in Pennsylvania, and an American hero. That is a PLF client who is standing up against just a jaw-breaking case of government overreach that's threatening his livelihood, the livelihoods of all of his employees, and the rights of every Pennsylvanian. Brian, thank you so much for your courage, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for the invite.
Well, you got it. I want to start first with your business. It's a family business, long time, started by your grandfather in 1950. Is that right?
Well, it's my uncle's father. Started the business in 1950. They started hauling livestock out of the Midwest, and it grew to 1976. My uncle bought it and transitioned in 1980 to some refrigerated freight along with livestock. In 1993, I joined the company, dispatching and growing the company, and we grew. Currently, we're at 85 trucks and 165 trailers. So I took ownership in 2023. So it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, well, and now you're helping feed the country from coast to coast. As you know, navigating a very heavily regulated industry like trucking, especially during super challenging economic times, definitely no cup of tea. Everyone remembers the truckers versus COVID, right? But then in 2021, kind of still in the thick of COVID, Pennsylvania adopts drastic new emission standards and a costly extended warranties for new heavy diesel vehicles, the heart of your industry. So tell us what these regulations mean for your company, or would mean for your company.
It's very costly, and it pits us unfairly at a disadvantage to other states with trucking emissions regulations, with warranty. They were forcing us to buy extended warranties. And we have our own shop. We like to do our own work. We think we can be more economical, and we like to do that. So they were forcing us to buy warranties for the new trucks, and also giving us regulations that just seem very challenging, very expensive, very demanding. In this industry, we cleaned up emissions. In 1980, one truck produced what 80 trucks produce today. So we've made tremendous strides, but they keep overreaching with these burdensome regulations, and it's not nationwide. It's statewide. So we got to compete with our next door neighbor in Ohio, who's getting trucks a lot cheaper, running their business, but we're nationwide. So we compete all over the country. So it really puts us at a disadvantage.
And the real rub, I mean, crushing enough for your company just on its face, But the real rub here also is that these new mandates did not even originate in Pennsylvania. No Pennsylvania regulator wrote these rules. No Pennsylvania lawmakers made any laws. So tell us who did that. I mean, I said it at the beginning, but you know this firsthand.
So it's really frustrating for me that in this day and age that we could have laws forced upon us without any say. If we have a federal law, we have representation with representatives that we elect in Washington. If we have a state law, we have representatives that we elect that go to Harrisburg and make the rule. But in some decision, somebody thought it was okay to give our rights away to California, who has no vested interest in Pennsylvania. They're going to make the laws that we have to follow. And that, to me, is just ridiculous to allow another state to force regulations on us without any input. We have no representation of our own laws. And to me, it was just, it's just incredibly unfair. And it doesn't work for Pennsylvanians. And no matter what industry, not just trucking, you wouldn't want them regulating how we swim in our lakes and with regulations for oceans, because they have oceans. It's just, to me, it's just beyond belief that we're even have to fight this in this day and age.
That's right. And in Pennsylvania, it's been happening since 2002. Your Pennsylvania Environmental Quality Board, the regulators there, adopted a regulation of their own that automatically adopts California's emissions rules, regulation by proxy, we like to call it. There's so many things wrong with it, not the least of which there's no expiration date. So all Pennsylvania's trucking companies, you're forever at the mercy of California. But the most important problem isn't actually for truckers and companies. It's for regulators, because under the Constitution's separation of powers, states just can't mindlessly outsource open-ended rulemaking power to other states. So now, Brian, with free representation by PLF, you are suing Pennsylvania regulators in state courts to keep your business in Pennsylvania and keep California regulators out. What made you say it's time to fight back in this way with legal action?
Well, I just thought it's so egregious. And we just had to stand up and say enough. I mean, this is not even something that's maybe, maybe not. This is clear that we cannot let another state dictate what we do here without any representation. We have no way to say, hey, stop, this doesn't make sense. California could say tomorrow, hey, the first of the year, you can only have electric trucks in Pennsylvania. Even though we don't have the infrastructure to support it, that's the law. That's what we have to comply with. And we have no say. We can't say, hey, we're going to not elect these officials making these crazy rules. We're just stuck. And that, to me, is beyond belief. Who would give up their powers or legislative powers to another state is beyond me.
That's insane. Well, we are working to definitely put an end to that. And there are a couple of silver linings in this regulatory storm. Brian, you're not only fighting alone, you've got some other family-owned trucking companies in Pennsylvania with you, as well as the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. So it's not like you are on this island alone. Of course, all of us at PLF as well. And the other thing too, this a lawsuit is actually on pause right now. That is thanks to Congress stepping in with the Congressional Review Act to pull the plug on California's emissions rulemaking power for other states. So while we wait to see if Congress's actions become final, these rubber stamped regulations at the moment are not enforceable, not in California, not in Pennsylvania, not anywhere. So stay tuned on that. So Brian, just some closing statements. We're running out of time, but what's it like suing the government? You probably never thought you'd be doing that.
Well, it's something I never thought I would do or would have to do, but I'm glad BLF was here to provide us an option. To go it alone to navigate this would have been probably financially overwhelming and daunting task. When they came to us, they said, this is what we can do. And I jumped right on board, and I had some pushback. Hey, people ask me, aren't you afraid for retaliation? Maybe, but somebody has to say something, because this will just continue down the road and it'll affect other businesses. And we just can't do that. I don't want to move my business to Ohio or a state that's less regulated because someone made a poor decision. And that's what I would be forced to do.
Yeah. Well, Brian, you certainly got me fired up today, and hopefully our listeners as well. It's been such a delight talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
And you can learn more about Peters Brothers v. Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and all the work we're doing at Pacific Legal Foundation at pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Thank you very much, Kathy. And now we turn to Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth, who kept close tabs on all of the election results of this past week. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Wasn't a good night for Republicans. Let's talk first. There were two gubernatorial races, one in the Commonwealth of Virginia, one in New Jersey. Both went the Democrats' way, Scott. Not really a surprise, but margins were a bit of a surprise. What do you make of all this?
Starting out in Virginia, my home state, I think that we obviously had an issue where Abigail Spanberger was running against Winsome Earle Sears, and Sears had been Glenn Youngkin's lieutenant governor. She sort of rode his coattails in 2021 to a historic victory following the election of Biden in 2020. And there's obviously a historical precedent where in elections you see sort of a boomerang back to the opposite party of the White House. And, you know, I think that we had a lot of hopes that we could do better in Virginia. Democrats want to try to cast this vision that they had excitement and enthusiasm behind their ticket. Spanberger received about 1.9 million votes, and Winsome Sears got about 1.4 million. So it was a pretty big blowout when you think about 14.5%. But the overall turnout in Virginia wasn't that different than 2021. And Glenn Youngkin running against Terry McAuliffe, there were 3.2 million voters in that race. We had about 3.3 million this week in Virginia. And I think that it really is a testament to how strong of a candidate Glenn Youngkin was in 2021. And then also, I think you got to think about, in fact, Donald Trump did not get involved in this race. He never endorsed Winsome Sears or the lieutenant gubernatorial candidate, John Reed. Instead, he just weighed in for Jason Miaris, and Miaris ran a good campaign, but ultimately that spread of 14% at the top of the ticket for Spanberger over Sears, it was something that Miaris was not able to overcome, and he lost to Jay Jones by a little bit less than 5%. Jay Jones is a guy that has obviously said reprehensible things about his political opponents, wishing them to be killed and for their kids to die in their mother's arms. And now he's the so-called top cop in Virginia. He doesn't have the experience to run that office, and there's going to be a lot of learning on the job. I think that he's also going to probably abdicate a lot of his decision-making to Abigail Spanberger and be less of an independent voice in the AG's office and more of a sort of a token leftist. So obviously the Virginia election results were incredibly disappointing. Spanberger's finish ahead of Sears also resulted in a sort of a blue wave in all those delegate races, which controls the state legislature. And, you know, you got to think about elections have consequences. And some people want to point to this idea that the government shutdown and the federal workers came out in a big way for Spanberger. To a degree, that's something that needs to be unpacked. But I think it's also very important that Republicans identify candidates that agree with the leader of our party, and that's Donald Trump. Trump's message of America first and making America great again led to a historic victory in 2024, where he only lost Virginia by 5.8%, but he won those other seven swing states. And as we look ahead to the 2026 midterms, my hope is that we have more candidates that are running on the Trump agenda, running to make sure that our economy is strong, our country is safe, and that we remain free, rather than the results of what happened, not just in Virginia, but in New Jersey. Jack Chiarelli lost by about 14%. And then Mamdani up in New York won the mayor's race pretty handedly. And he's a communist. Obviously, the front page of the papers is saying he's a socialist. But if you look at his policies when it comes to making near everything free in New York City, it's going to result in a fleeing of capital away from arguably the strongest city in the world when it comes to economic output. Then you also think about considerations for crime and his policies to defund the police, his policies for free food and free housing. I think that it's just going to be a nightmare scenario, and hopefully Mamdani becomes sort of the leader of the far left and is somebody that Republicans can hold up as a poster child for exactly what we do not want in the rest of our great country.
And is that what is likely to happen here, Scott, that you have Zoran Mamdani as the new mayor of New York City? He's going to try to enact a wide range of socialist policies. Does he now become the face of the Democrat Party?
It's hard to say. I think Republicans will want to make him a face of the Dem Party, but you know, I think it's pretty clear from the last couple of weeks that Barack Obama is still the leader of the Democratic Party and got folks like AOC that are pushing their rank and file to go farther to the left. And obviously she was a big supporter of Mamdani along with Bernie Sanders. Those are the folks that want to grow government so big that we don't have economic freedom and opportunity and that we basically confiscate wealth and crush the American dream. I think that that's sort of the worst case scenario for what's coming. But what we can hope is that in these midterms that are coming up now in 1 year, we're going to select great candidates in the primaries that support President Trump and that the MAGA voters that actually came out for Trump in 2024 get excited about.
And so tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Well, Club for Growth is based in Washington, D.C., united in the idea of economic freedom, opportunity, and liberty. Our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can actually visit clubforgrowth.org and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thanks again for being here.
You're welcome.
The extent of presidential power to impose tariffs is now before the Supreme Court of the United States. There are some interesting potential consequences, as we learn from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
If the Supreme Court upholds President Donald Trump's sweeping emergency tariff powers, then a future president could likely slap huge tariffs on gas-powered cars and other goods that emit carbon and other greenhouse gases. And that's not speculation, folks. That's the conclusion from the Trump administration's own attorney during Wednesday's oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. I just finished listening to that nearly 3 hour long oral argument over the tariffs at the U.S. Supreme Court. I think this is one of the most important Supreme Court cases that we've had maybe in this entire century, to be honest. It's a case that deals with obviously, the tariffs and Trump's ability to continue to impose them. But it also asks some very important questions about the fundamental structure of the government, about the separation of powers, about the limits of executive power and executive power over the economy. And those questions, the answers to those questions, will be relevant, obviously, for the Trump administration, but also, we have to remember, they will be relevant for every administration that comes after. So as you'd expect, there were a lot of different arguments that got thrown around during that oral argument. Again, it was nearly 3 hours long. I think in some ways, the most interesting one to me is how far the Trump administration is trying to go and trying to stretch the meaning of words in the underlying law that Trump is using to impose tariffs. I've talked about this on this show before, but Trump is using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, otherwise known as IEEPA. That's the law that is the foundation for most of the tariffs that he's imposed this year. The text of that law grants a whole bunch of powers to the president to regulate, block, nullify, restrict, modify, and so on international trade. But one thing it doesn't do is it doesn't give the power to tax or tariff. That's not specifically in the law. And there was a lot of debate over that during the oral argument about whether the word regulate, the Trump administration claims that the word regulate in there implies the ability to tariff or tax. And I think most of the justices on the court were pretty skeptical of that argument, but there was a lot of engagement with that. And I think that's probably the ultimate point upon which this case will turn. But I actually want to talk about a slightly different point today, which is where I started off this conversation about whether Trump's tariff powers could allow a future president to put big tariffs on gas-powered cars or other vehicles like that. And again, this has to do with IEEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act which is the law that is underpinning all of these tariffs. Now, the emergency in there, the emergency that Trump has claimed, is actually twofold. Some of the tariffs have been imposed as part of an attempt to counter the flow of fentanyl into the United States, while other tariffs are part of the White House's response to trade deficits with other countries, which it has called a unique and extraordinary threat. And reasonable people might disagree whether either of those things should be called an emergency. I think it's particularly weird that the tariffs are being imposed even on countries with which we run a trade surplus, even in the name of reducing trade deficits. But as a legal matter, all of that is somewhat beside the point. The president has broad authority under IEEPA to declare emergencies whenever and however he sees fit. The key question before the court is whether the law allows tariffs to be imposed once an emergency has been declared. And that brings us to this crucial exchange, which happened between Justice Neil Gorsuch and Solicitor General D. John Sauer, who was arguing the case for the Trump administration. Gorsuch asked a hypothetical. He said, okay, if we uphold your argument here, your understanding of how IEEPA is supposed to work, couldn't a future president impose tariffs on gas-powered cars? Here's the exchange as it happened in the oral arguments. The first voice you'll hear is Gorsuch, and then you'll hear the response from Sauer.
Could the president impose a 50% tariff on gas-powered cars and auto parts to deal with the unusual and extraordinary threat from abroad of climate change?
It's very likely that that could be done.
I think that has to be the logic of your view.
Yeah, in other words, obviously this administration would say that's a hoax, it's not a real crisis, but...
I'm sure you would.
Yes, but that'd be a question for Congress under our interpretation, not for the courts.
All right.
So yes, this is just a hypothetical. I get that. But it's not a very far-fetched one. I mean, the Biden administration reportedly considered declaring a so-called climate emergency and invoking IEEPA to do it, and to do a whole bunch of other things. They never actually did that. This was something that was being discussed reportedly in the White House around the same time that Congress passed the Build Back Better plan. Now, would the Biden White House have used IEEPA to impose tariffs under the grounds of a so-called climate emergency? Maybe. We never found out exactly what that would look like. But do you trust that Gavin Newsom, who has tried to ban gas-powered lawn equipment as governor of California, do you trust that he wouldn't try something like this if he was president? Or what about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Or take your pick, any other backer of the so-called Green New Deal? So this is one of the unfortunate realities of Trump's tariff scheme. He has stretched executive power over the economy to new limits. And you know that the next Democratic administration will be absolutely thrilled to assume those powers, if the Supreme Court allows those powers to continue to exist. And I know, a lot of Republicans will be very upset if the Supreme Court strikes down the tariffs, because partisanship is seemingly all that matters these days in politics. But if that happens, I would urge everybody to keep in mind that limits on executive power are good for America and good for the conservative vision of America. If Trump gets what he wants when it comes to these tariffs, it could and it will open the door for a whole lot worse. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our coverage of the oral arguments in the tariff case and everything else going on around the country this week at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, says Donald Trump is not a king, but he did get a crown. He talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Last summer, I did a commentary making fun of the No Kings movement. It's easy to poke fun at, given that the very name and message of No Kings is, well, obviously incorrect. Donald Trump has been called numerous things by leftists and liberals, most of which are at least subjective and debatable. For instance, one could argue in circles about how to best define the word democracy, and then whether Trump is somehow unilaterally destroying it. They've even denounced Trump as everything from a bigot to a narcissist. Again, subjective terms. But a king? Well, that's pure nonsense from the get-go, because obviously Donald Trump is, of course, not a monarch. Even if Donald Trump wanted to be king, he couldn't. Gosh, Trump can't even abolish the Department of Education. That's because in our constitutional system of separation of powers and checks and balances, the legislative branch stops him, the president. Trump can't even unilaterally keep open or shut down the federal government. Ha! Some king! And yet, speaking of education, that hasn't stopped the American Federation of Teachers from pushing the No Kings movement. The AFT's website the morning of the recent nationwide No Kings rallies was filled with silly, incendiary language on, quote, why fascists fear teachers, and no crowns, no thrones, no kings. Gadzooks! You'd think the teachers would know that Trump not only isn't a king, but has neither a crown nor a throne. The AFT, as an organization of teachers, ought to be educating kids in a proper understanding of what words like monarch and fascist actually mean. But apparently the ignorance that pervades American public education starts at the top. To his immense credit, Donald Trump has seized upon this spectacle to have a little fun. Trump has trolled the No Kings crowd, posting manipulated photos of himself wearing a crown. You can't help but laugh. That no doubt had them howling even louder. See, see, we said he wants to be a king. There you go. But alas, amid my lampooning of the No Kings crowd, it looks like they're actually having the last laugh. Well, not the last laugh, because they don't laugh. They're always too angry. I should say the No Kings crowd is having the last word. They've been suddenly vindicated. That is because Donald Trump, ladies and gentlemen, has in fact received a crown. Yes, it's true. If you didn't catch the news, Donald J. Trump recently received a crown during his swing through Asia. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung made Trump the first American president to receive South Korea's highest honor, the Grand Order of Mungwa, replete with a replica of a dazzling golden crown. No doubt Trump can't spell, let alone pronounce Mungwa. What does that matter? Mungwa or cowabunga, Trump at long last got his crown. So apparently the South Koreans know an authoritarian when they see one. That'll make sense to the No Kings folks. They will tell you, actually they will scream from the streets to the top of their lungs, that Donald Trump is an authoritarian. South Korea's leaders apparently know a king when they see one. Thus, they took the step of awarding Trump the crown that our homegrown No Kings movement had seen coming all along. The irony was not lost on the political scientists at the New York Times. America's newspaper of record confirmed in a headline, quote, Trump has likened himself to a king. South Korea gave him a crown, unquote. Indeed, New York Times, spot on, brilliant analysis. And so there you go. The likes of the American Federation of Teachers have shown themselves not to be the dunces that I thought they were, but rather astute political prognosticators. I guess they too, like the South Koreans, know a monarch when they see one. Impressive, AFT. Who would have thunk it? The No Kings movement has proven astutely prophetic after all. Here's hoping that Trump will start wearing his crown soon. I suggest that the Donald don the crown for his next State of the Union address. I think the liberals and the No Kings crowd would just love that. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KSAK-FM in Walnut, California, KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas, along with KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.